Good afternoon. So last time we covered this idea of kernel mode, the idea that our hardware wants to support operating systems that want to run programs without letting the programs do anything the system can do. So the most common mechanism for enabling this is that we'll have this special mode called kernel mode, where various dangerous operations, things the OS might not want to allow every program to just do, are allowed. And the OS and the hardware will cooperate to ensure that only operating system written code actually ends up running in kernel mode, and that's how the OS makes sure that only things it wants to happen of these dangerous operations actually do happen. Examples were like reading from a hard drive. The OS can enforce that, you know, programs only read files they're supposed to from a hard drive and not other ones by writing the code that runs in kernel. So then we needed to deal with the issue of, well, how do we start running code in kernel mode if our normal programs shouldn't be running in kernel mode? And we'd hope that you can't just, you know, defeat this protection by saying, oh, please run my routine in kernel mode and have it the system just do that for you. And the mechanism for this is we have some hardware support for running some routine the OS specifies in kernel mode when some event happens. And this is basically a way to allow the OS to help either a running program or the hardware handle something that the program or the hardware can't deal with itself. And our first example of this kind of thing was with system calls, that these were exceptions a program deliberately triggered because it needed the OS's help to do something. And examples were typically things that needed kernel mode access, like doing input or output. We also talked about some other kinds of exceptions, which were cases where the hardware needed the OS's help to decide what to do. So one example of this is when programs did things that the hardware didn't expect, like accessing memory that wasn't in bounds or dividing by zero. Another was dealing with I/O. When a key press happens, the hardware doesn't know what to do about that. The OS needs to handle it, and an exception is a way of asking the OS, please handle this key press that just happened. And we also have this timer, and that was supported so if you're running a program that keeps running forever, the OS has a way of asking the hardware to help it, you know, stop this program from running forever by triggering the OS to run, and the OS can, you know, when it's running, decide not to keep that program running. So questions about these, about exceptions we covered last time? Yes, okay. So your question is about external exceptions, like things that stop an infinite loop. How does the OS determine when that happens? So we have two things listed here that would stop an infinite loop. One is this sort of I/O event. So the hardware kind of by default is set up so when you have a key press or like a network packet coming in, it's going to ask for help in dealing with that, and it's going to run the OS. So that will just naturally interrupt the infinite loop, or even normal code that isn't an infinite loop, to try to handle that event promptly. And then we have this timer. And the way this timer works is that this is something the operating system would configure before switching to a program that might have an infinite loop. And it kind of provides a safety mechanism that if that program takes too long, the timer will go off and the OS will get to run. And then when the OS runs, it can decide, do I want to let the program keep running? Do I want to do something else or whatever? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, as far as the timer is concerned, what if you have some process that takes a long time? Does that affect it at all?
As far as the timer is concerned, does it affect it at all if some processes take a long time?
Yeah, but
so the timer is basically a little clock in the hardware, and the OS can tell the hardware, here's how often I want that clock to go off, and it can adjust that based on whatever decisions it made. It's not going to be affected by what else is running. It's kind of, you can kind of think of it like an alarm clock the processor has that's independent of instruction execution. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Are
does that like run alongside like the recursive like Stack Overflow error?
So the question is, how does this deal? How does this relate to like a Stack Overflow error?
Like, does the timer like run alongside it?
Does it kind of run alongside? Question, does timer track things like an infinite recursion process? So the timers I'm talking about, like, don't know anything about what's happening on the processor. This is like basically a little piece of hardware that's like an alarm clock. Like, it's set to go off at some time, and it will go off then. It doesn't know what the processor's doing. And if you want to stop it from going off, the OS needs to run and tell the hardware to tell the timer, stop going. Does that answer your question? Question, how does the timer know how long the process should last before setting the alarm to go off? The OS configures it. So a common thing OSs might do, there's multiple strategies. One thing you could do is you could configure the timer to go off every millisecond at boot, and then the OS runs every millisecond and checks, oh, is the program running too long or not? If not, just go back. Otherwise, do something about it. So that'd be one strategy. The OS could also like adjust that time before it starts running a program. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So the OS can communicate with the timer after boot to change the amount of time to wait for?
The question, the OS can communicate with the timer after boot to change the amount of time to wait for? Yes. So typically, a processor will come with a configurable timer. How configurable varies, but some, you know, there's some amount of configuration the OS can do. Other questions? Okay, so besides exceptions, we also mentioned dealing with memory, and the mechanism that we'll explore in much more detail later was this idea of address translation, which gives programs the notion of this address space. And you can kind of think of the program has this sort of notion of memory that we call an address space that kind of looks like its own memory, even though we know it's implemented by translating those addresses to real addresses. And the OS can do that in a way where we have like two or three programs loaded in one memory, but the addresses they see all translate to different things, so the programs can't interfere with each other. You can't accidentally access another program's memory, because every time you try to, the processor takes your address, puts it through a function the OS set, and that function says, oh, goes to this number, and that number's never the same as any other program. It's just done by the OS, you know, configuring this as it runs programs. And we mentioned with the combination of this sort of address spaces and exceptions, something we can do with our processors, we can share it between different programs. And we'll talk about that in more detail today, about what's the OS doing to do that. But the basic idea is when exceptions happen, you know, the OS doesn't need to do like what we saw with a system call of handle what the program requested, then go back to the program. It could instead handle the exception by deciding, I'm going to start running a different program now. And then sometime later, it can go back to the program that it stopped running. And by doing this, we can sort of share a processor over time, which I call time multiplexing. So we're, you know, multiple programs are using one processor, but you know they're not doing it at the same time. They're kind of we're slicing up time into these little chunks, running the program for a bit, and running another program, then another program, and so on. And in this way, we can run sort of as many programs as we have space for, even if we only have one core. Question, yes?
Going back to like the OS setting the mapping function, is it working like similar to like a hash function?
The question is, does the OS setting the mapping function that's work similar to a hash function? It is somewhat, it's usually a little more structured than that. We'll talk about the exact format that's most commonly used later. Like the simplest thing you could do is it could just be like add this to the addresses and check if they're in a right bound. And there's some old systems that work that way. Modern systems have a much more flexible way of setting that function, which we'll talk about in a lot of detail in a couple weeks. Yeah?
You went over an example yesterday that had like two programs trying to access RAX and the memory associated with that. I know that the memory mapping is different between programs, but do the programs share the same registers, or is like RAX one program maybe a different register for another one?
So the question is, I had an example yesterday where I had two programs both using RAX. How does that work? Are they both using the same register? We will talk about that in detail later. And I hopefully will answer your question then. Other questions? Yeah.
Does multiplexing happen on multi-core processors too?
Question, does this time multiplexing idea happen on multi-core processors too? Yes. Because quite often we'll have more programs running than we have cores. Or especially more threads, as we'll talk about later, even if we have less programs. Other questions? Okay, so some logistics, some anonymous feedback, some asking, hey, could you do some more like live running code? So I guess, so you can see like things that happen and errors and so on. I'm not sure this would be as useful as you think, because when I do demos, usually I try to make them very canned so things don't break. But that means you'll learn less about the process of like debugging anything. So I'm gonna practice it beforehand. My problems with the quiz system being disconnected from the network last week notwithstanding. And part of why I don't do them is usually a time choice that even there's always a bunch of downtime in setting up a live demo, which is why I like often showed the output I got on a slide. I do probably need to go slower whenever I have code on slides. This is a problem I have. And you're welcome to ask questions about the code to help slow me down. And then can I explain system calls and time multiplexing again? We will talk about that more today because I definitely didn't finish talking about it last time. Such as the question about what about the registers? That we definitely didn't actually talk about, and it's kind of important. So, but to help review this picture here that maybe helps illustrate things. So we started by talking about system calls. So we have a program running a bunch of instructions that I represent by this sort of squiggly line. And what it's gonna do for a system call, it's gonna encode the things it wants to do in registers for the OS to figure out later. Then it's gonna run this special instruction that's gonna have the hardware go to the system call handler and run it in kernel mode. So this is OS code that was set up at boot. And this code's gonna read those registers the program wrote to, figure out what does the program actually wanna do? Does it want to write to the screen? Does it want to read from a file on disk? What does it want to do? Maybe do it, or maybe say, no, you can't do that. And then typically it will exit and go back to running the program in user mode and let the program deal with whatever the results of its request were. And sort of our general exception idea kind of works the same way. We just have a different event, possibly, triggering the exception, but we still run some handler the OS wrote. And we had this notion that the OS doesn't need to actually return back to the same code that we were running before if it doesn't want to. So the OS could decide, if it wants, doesn't have to when it exits that exception handler, that it should arrange to go back to a different program. And that's sort of the fundamental idea of how it does that time multiplexing we talked about. So questions on this sort of general flow of exceptions. Yeah. Question, when exception handler, we go to kernel mode, always handles it, then we exit the handler, go to user mode? Yes. There's one thing I'm simplifying a little bit, which is that it's possible for exceptions to happen in kernel mode, which I'm just kind of ignoring, but that's something that can also happen. And when they happen in kernel mode, they still invoke the handler. They just, you know, don't go from user to kernel mode, they just go stay in kernel mode. And if you exit that, normally you'll still be in kernel. Yeah?
So when the exception handler finishes up, does it go from kernel to user mode and then jump back to user memory? Or does it go back to
So the question is, how does this process of exiting the exception handling work and going to user mode work? Are there different steps in the middle? And because we need something to flip that bit from kernel to user mode, generally there's special hardware support for this exit exception handler operation to enable sort of simultaneously jumping and flipping the kernel to user mode bit. Does that answer your question? So the question, wouldn't it be a normal return instruction? Yeah. So there's going to be some special instruction to help the OS do this. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's skip ahead to where we were last time. So we talked about that if you time our empty timing, we were just timing nothing, and we saw that we can see all the signs of these exception handlers running through how long nothing takes. And what's happening there is that each of these sort of spikes is that in between our two get time calls, there was an exception handler that ran and did something, including in some cases probably switching back to another program and then switching back to us by some later exception. And this is sort of typically what ends up happening, is that we have some exception happen while our program is running, the OS switches to another program, sometimes, not always, and then it switches back to us sometime later. And I'm sort of showing this sort of in the loop case. We also can have this triggered by any sort of exception, not just sort of a timer went off. We could have like, when you make a system call, maybe the OS will decide to handle that system call, I'm not going to switch back to you right away. So, for example, if you ask to read from the keyboard and there's no input on the keyboard, probably we should just run something else while you're waiting for input from the keyboard. And then later on, maybe input comes in from the keyboard and the OS could use that as an opportunity to switch to the program that was waiting for that input right away rather than just, you know, waiting for a timer to go off. Any question here?
Yeah, I was going to ask about the OS decide which programs to run, like the switch.
Question, how does the OS decide which programs to switch to? So that's not a topic we're going to really cover in this course. Like, the simplest way is you could just, you know, have a list and choose the first thing on the list. If you take 4414, presumably that will be covered. And there's lots of different strategies that real OS is used for that, with all sorts of trade-offs. Other questions? Okay. And another thing we have exceptions for that maybe less intuitively sort of switch programs is, let's say I have a program that like triggers an out-of-bounds memory access. That's kind of the same thing going on. We switch away from the program and start running something else. The only difference from our other scenarios is that we probably don't ever switch back to that program. But it's the same mechanism of, you know, switching to another program. We just probably never have a reason to go back. So this idea of sharing the processor over time and switching between programs when these exceptions happen gives us an abstraction that we'll call a thread. And this idea of a thread is that we kind of have this illusion that we have a run processor. When you've written code, you know, and like looked at assembly in CS01, you kind of wrote assembly as if you own the whole processor. And in particular, you kind of said, oh, I have all these registers I can use, I have this program counter, I can jump around. And you've acted as if I'm the only thing running on the processor. You never had to, when writing C or assembly, worry about what about these other programs for almost anything you would do. And we kind of implement this some way with many threads sharing a processor. And an issue that someone asked about that I promised I'd get to is, how do we deal with all these register values in the program counter? Right, our hardware only has one set of register values and one program counter. How can I run several programs on one core, one processor, using that. Where do the registers and the program counter go? And the answer is that the OS is going to be responsible for saving those somewhere while your program is not running on the processor. So what it's going to do when that exception happens and it decides, oh, I want to run a different program, it's going to copy your register values in your program counter somewhere for safekeeping, and it's going to copy some other program's register values onto the registers. And that's how it's going to be able to go back to a different program. And it's also probably, you know, in addition to this, and, you know, change the address mapping for the new program. Because we said each program has its own set of addresses, we'll also change that as part of this process. And this operation is called a context switch. And the information we save somewhere for later, we call the context of your thread. So a way of thinking about it is that let's say I have two programs, A and B. When program A is running on the processor, we have all its registers and its program counter loaded. And, you know, these things have pointers to its memory, you know, pointers that are going to work with that address translation we talked about earlier. And while this is happening, the OS has stored in memory some register values for another program, in this case, program B. And when the OS decides, I want to switch to program B, don't want to be running program A anymore, it's going to move process A stuff to its memory. It's going to make a copy there. And it's going to move its saved data for program B onto the processor by just copying all those things from its memory to each register before switching back to user mode. Yes?
What does ZF stand for?
SF and ZF are some of the flag registers. Other questions? Yes? So the question, are the registers in the OS memory as much RAX as the registers in the CPU?
Yes.
As far as program A is concerned, absolutely.
Okay.
Like, obviously, as far as what's happening physically, they're going to be stored in slower memory. They could be encoded in a different way. So not physically. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So the question is, if we have multiple processes that share some memory, do they still have independent registers? Yes. And commonly, we will have one process which in fact has multiple threads, so kind of like has multiple virtual processors it can use, and each of those threads will still have their own registers, even though in that case that the program will share all their memory. The threads will share all their memory. Yes. So the question is, gosh, I need to copy all these registers, and maybe you remember hearing that x86 in fact has a whole bunch of extra registers I'm not showing, like for floating point. Doesn't this take a lot of time? And the answer is, well, it's not super cheap, especially when you have things like floating point and vector registers, which, you know, so it turns out x86, if you read the full modern x86 machines, have an additional 16 256-bit registers that might need to be saved here, get big. But it's still pretty trivial on the timescales we're worried about. So it's orders microseconds to do this. And it might be something we do maybe every millisecond on an interactive system. And it turns out that more of the cost of doing this operation has to do with caches. So when people measure how much slower does my system run because I'm switching from program A to program B to program A? Most of the performance impact is actually from program A's memory not being in the cache in the fast, small memories when we switch back to program A after running program B for a while. That usually is a lot more performance impact than the actual direct cost of copying the register values. And we'll talk more about caches later to learn like how that works, why would program A's values go away, and so on. Yeah?
So just to be clear, when OS switches from like, context A to context, the process A memory, that doesn't have to be written to OS memory, right? That just stays in the place where it's previously. It's not process A memory, with the stack, it's not copied anywhere.
So the question is, when we're switching from one program to another, we don't have to like copy its stack in other memory? Yes. Because we have this address translation idea, if we want to change, you know, what's at a particular address, we just change that mapping. So we don't have to remove anything from memory when we're switching from one program to another, remove anything around in memory even. We just change the mapping, and that makes it so all the program's addresses work the way that OS chooses them to work. You know. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we've learned about exceptions and context switches. So let's do a little exercise here. So I have a list of a bunch of things that we could have happen on a system. I'm asking which of them are going to have an exception involved somehow, and which of them are going to have a context switch involved somehow. And check to see if you agree with your neighbor about works. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with which ones require or are going to involve an exception. So who thinks A is going to involve an exception? Okay, so we have, I'm just recording what some, how, who thinks B is going to involve an exception? Okay, so I would say most people think this, okay. Who thinks C is going to involve an exception? So I have a few for that, okay. Who thinks D is going to involve an exception? So we have most think that. Who thinks E is going to involve an exception? Okay, have a few for that. And who thinks F is going to involve an exception? We have, say, some for that. Okay. So let's go through, let's start with the ones where most people say there will be an exception. So program writing a file to disk. So one of the things we mentioned when we talked about kernel mode is that the hardware doesn't give programs direct access to the disk generally. And a reason for this is that the hardware doesn't understand this part of the disk are user A's files and this part of the disk are user B's files. So in order to enforce those sorts of rules, we need the operating system to be involved and do stuff in kernel mode. We can't do that without an exception happening to switch from the program writing in user mode to the kernel mode that actually talks to the disk and figures out where to write without interfering with other files. So this would definitely require an exception. Okay. So the other one we had the most consensus on was D. So a program exiting. And a program exiting involves a bunch of things that the program can't do itself. The biggest thing is that we need to start running something else, and the program doesn't know what to start running, so it needs to ask the OS for help with that. Also, we need to like unload the program's memory, and the program can't really do that itself. It doesn't manage like all those memory address space mappings. The OS does it. So it's going to need to ask for help. It needs to ask to have code running kernel mode to change that information. So this is going to require an exception to occur. And that those in both of these cases, the exception is going to be most likely a system call. Okay. Question, yeah. So question for C, we'll get to C later. I'm gonna start with other ones which I think are more simple. So we'll do E. So few people said E should require an exception. And let's think about what does returning from one function to another do? And this is going to change some registers. And that's really it. You might say, wait a moment, we're removing stuff from the stack. That's changing the stack pointer. That's just a register. There's nothing else we need to do. And changing registers, that's not kernel mode stuff. That's something the processor will just do in user mode. So there's no reason for an exception for this returning operation. And related to that, I have F. So F is kind of a little tricky. So I think the main thought people have to say F requires an exception is you think of what does popping a value from the stack do? Well, it makes the stack smaller. And making the stack smaller sounds like we're changing the mapping for addresses in the program. And surely that needs the OS to do it because I said that mapping is set by the OS. So, and that's a reasonable idea. But it turns out that the way that mapping works doesn't get dynamically changed as you adjust the stack pointer. So when you push and pop things from the stack, it doesn't actually directly change sort of what's allocated to your program, except in some cases where the mapping wasn't already set up. So popping, you might say, shouldn't that deallocate space in actual memory? Well, it turns out it's not going to. What's going to happen is the processor, so popping a value, we're going to copy from memory to a register, and we're going to update RSP. That's what we're going to do, copying from memory to a register, provided that memory is already in our address mapping and is valid, which it probably is because we pushed the value earlier for this to work. That's not a problem. That doesn't require an exception. The operating system doesn't need to get involved. The memory is already set up to be used, definitely, because we pushed it earlier. So that's no problem. And updating RSP, I probably should write these more legibly. So updating RSP, so it kind of sounds like, oh, it's the stack pointer, it's special. Updating it, you know, involves stuff with memory. But as far as the hardware is concerned, updating RSP is the same thing as updating RAX. It's just doing arithmetic and storing the results. If that produces an address that doesn't work, that doesn't actually matter when we're doing the pop instruction. It matters later. And this means, because that's all the processor is doing, there's actually no chance for the OS to get to run here if it did want to, like, actually have you have less memory for your stack. If it wants to do that, it needs to find some other way of doing it. It's not going to get to automatically run and do that. So there will, in fact, be no exception that happens in this case, even though you might want it to be the case that, well, when we pop a value from the stack, shouldn't the OS actually, like, free up some memory for other programs? Sorry, the OS doesn't have a way of doing that. So if it wants to do that, it needs some other way to figure out that you popped the value. It's not going to happen automatically. Yes, over there.
Does this only apply to pops, or, like, can push it, or pushes different?
So the question, would push be different? So if the memory is already allocated in the mapping, push is not different. If the memory isn't allocated, what might happen, as we'll discuss later when we talk about virtual memory, is that you'll get an exception will occur because you're trying to write to memory that isn't part of your mapping. And the OS can, in fact, handle that by doing something other than crashing your program. And we'll talk about that later. Does that answer your question? Other questions on F? Okay. So then let's go to A. So A is kind of tricky because there's some standard library functions which definitely need exceptions to happen. So for example, if I'm printing something to the screen or reading something, that definitely needs exceptions to happen because we can't actually do that in user mode. We need kernel mode code to run. But sort of the general idea of calling a library function, well, doesn't really need it. So this is no for many library functions, for functions like, for no for, I guess, the actual call, so that's one thing. So the call part, right, before the library function starts running, that doesn't need an exception to happen. If the library function needs help from the OS, it's going to start running and then decide to get asked for help from the OS by making a system call. Like making the call to printf itself won't actually trigger the exception. It's going to be inside the printf function after it starts running from that call. And the actual call, but maybe as part of it, but maybe in the function body, the library function body, and not for some, and never for some library functions. For, you know, string copy, for example, and a whole bunch of other functions like that. There's lots of library functions which don't ever need to make a system call, even after they start running. Like, string copy doesn't do that. It just does a copy. And that usually doesn't need any exceptions to happen. There's some ones which do, like printf. If it will show something on the screen, probably needs to make a system call to do that. But just the but calling a library function itself is no, both because the call part doesn't do it. If it happens, it happens after the function starts running from that call, and because a lot of library functions that you call don't actually need help from the kernel. They can do everything they want to do in user mode. Some questions about that? So then we have C. Program A goes to sleep, letting program B run. Right. There was a question earlier saying, well, wait, is sleep like a system call? And, well, often it is. And that makes the answer really simple if sleep's a system call. Maybe they say, maybe there's a way of having program A go to sleep that doesn't involve a system call. And the answer, I think, would still be yes then, because in order to switch to program B, we need to load stuff that's in the OS memory. We need to change the address mapping. And that's stuff that we can't do without being in kernel mode. So because we know we're switching to program B, program A is not going to have access to program B stuff to switch to it. So we're going to have kernel mode be involved, which means an exception needs to happen so the OS can run in kernel mode to do that. Question there? Where context switch coming? We'll get to that next. Yeah.
So would it be fair to say that a context switch always has an exception preceding it?
So question, would it be fair to say that a context switch always has an exception preceding it? At least a context switch between two different programs. Okay. Other questions? So that's on context switches. So questions about reasons, sorry, and exceptions. Questions about reasons for exceptions. Okay, so let me go through the second part, which is going to be our context switches. So who thinks A is going to have a context switch? So I have, also write these down. So I have none. Who thinks B is going to need a context switch? Couple. So I have few. So doing context switches. Who thinks C is going to need a context switch? So I have most. Who thinks D is going to need a context switch? Okay, I have some for that. Who thinks E is going to need a context switch? Okay. Also have some for that. And who thinks F is going to need a context switch? Okay. So we'll start with the simple ones. I would agree for A and F. There's no context switch because we're just still running the same program. Now let's get to, and for C, there's definitely a context switch because we start running one program, we end up running another one. And we explicitly say we let another program run, that needs a context switch, assuming we're all both on the same processor. So then how about D? Does D have a context switch? And we had some disagreement here. So I would say yes, because what's going to happen after the program exits? We aren't going to keep running the same program. When you're running something else, we have to switch to something else. So this is going to have a context switch, definitely, because when the program exits, we can't just keep running it. We're going to have to switch to load something else to run, and that's going to be a context switch. So questions on that? Program exiting having a context switch involved. So I think a reason people often say it's not really a context switch is that maybe if we're clever, you know, but we don't really need to save. Don't need to save sort of old register values. So yes, maybe we could do that context switch, we could optimize that and like skip some steps. Yes, that's true. Most OSs don't actually do that because it's not really worth having special case code for the rare case of a program exiting, but it's something you could do. So most OSs will save the registers and then discard them to handle that case. Okay. Writing a file to disk. So if the disk is available immediately, we can just have the OS code run in kernel mode, and it can talk to the hard drive, write the data, and then go back to the same user program. There's no context switch there. You might say, well, wait a moment, we had like this call to kernel mode. Aren't we like saving the program's registers because of like it's a call? And yes. So function calls, we're not gonna call those context switches, even though like they're similar, right? Because when we make a function call, and when we make a system call for similar reasons, yeah, we're gonna have to save some register values so we can do work with our new register values. But we're not gonna call this a context switch because there's no notion of saving values to be restored much later, right? With a context switch, we're kind of saving some values and restoring some other values, right? With the function call, we're saving some values, but we're saving them to replace them with some new values and gonna restore them right away. With a context switch, there's no definite time we'll restore them. And we're usually restoring values that have been saved much, much, much earlier. We're not just replacing them with completely new values. Right, we have this notion of, in a context switch, there's some sort of swapping going on. And that's not really the case in a function call or a system call. Even though, yes, there's some register manipulation going on that superficially looks similar. Question, yeah?
You're saying for like function call, you're just pushing the return address to the stack versus like copying registers in OS,
So is the difference that I'm just pushing it out, like pushing versus copying a bunch of registers? So I wouldn't say the number of registers we're copying is the difference. I would say like how permanent the place we're copying the registers to and that we're usually restoring other registers that were saved earlier is what the difference is. Because if we think of a function that like uses all the registers, the beginning of the function, yeah, it's gonna start by save RAX, save RBX, save RCX. Which kind of looks a lot like a context switch. But with a context switch, we wouldn't be saving those on the stack. We'd be saving them somewhere that's longer term. And we wouldn't be saving them so we could copy temporary values in there. We'd be saving them to copy back old values that we expect to be on the registers for a while. Does that answer your question? Other questions? What I saw. So this is not a context switch. This is not a context switch, but yes, we may, save regs to the stack sort of while the OS works. Right, but that's just, dealing with temporary values in a function. And the same thing is kind of true here, but sort of restoring saved regs from before function overwrote. So those aren't context switches because we're not saving into kind of a semi-permanent location and not restoring old things, but yes, there's saving and restoring of registers in a function call, which is very similar, from a point of view of what does the assembly sort of outline look like to a context switch. Other questions? Okay, and on the slides I will post, I have worked out versions of what I wrote down that are more readable. Questions about exercise. Okay, so some last things about exceptions. So I've carefully avoided using many terms for exceptions besides exception and system call. In our reading, we have particular terms that say interrupts are the externally triggered exceptions, like for IO or the timer. Faults are the names for errors and events in programs, like accessing out of bounds memory or dividing by zero. And traps are for intentionally triggered exceptions, which the only type we know of is system calls, but there could be others. And the reason I didn't use these terms much, and also why I'm not going to test you on these terms, is because everyone uses different terms. And in fact, most people use all of these terms, but with different meanings. So if you read the x86 manuals, for example, they'll call everything interrupts. If you read some other processor manuals, they'll call everything traps. Yeah. And some other manuals will call everything faults. It just depends who's writing things down. So if you're reading documentation in the real world, you're going to have to check, what do they actually mean by interrupt? What do they actually mean by fault? Because it varies. They're always going to be one of these types of exceptions, but there could be a name for a specific type, it could be a name for all of them, depending on who decided to write things down. Questions about terms? Okay. And so one final thing about our doing with context switches. So we had these kind of two abstractions we talked about. One was this notion of a thread. So a thread, was kind of this virtual processor. It has its own registers, its own program counter, and it's that you write your program as if you own a processor, but you're actually using a thread. And the difference between a thread and the real processor is that a thread might be implemented by sort of sharing a processor with other programs over time. And we had this notion of an address space, which we said was implemented with address translation. So you use all the memory addresses you want, or all the ones the OS gives you, but in fact, that's going to map to the addresses on the real machine via some way the OS sets up, and you're sharing the memory that, you don't notice you're sharing, but you're sharing it with all these other programs. And together, this kind of gives you this notion of a dedicated machine, where you have a thread that represents a processor, and an address space that represents the memory. And in fact, you could have, as we'll talk about later in the semester, multiple threads, so kind of like your program has multiple virtual processors. And these are implemented to get on top of a real processor that might be shared with several threads, and on top of a real memory that might be shared with several address spaces. And when we combine these two things, one or more threads and an address space, we call that a process. And that's sort of most of the work of the OS is implementing this abstraction of a process. So giving you this kind of dedicated machine illusion, because it's not really dedicated, but you can code as if you have a dedicated machine, but it's actually implemented by sharing the real machine across many programs. So questions on this idea of a process? Okay, so in our last 15-ish minutes, we'll talk about what will be the subject of the lab next week, which is something called signals. So signals are kind of like a version of exceptions for processes. So we talked about exceptions being kind of a thing for the OS to do things when, the hardware or programs need the OS's help. And signals are providing the same kind of call your code to do things, but for processes. And with exceptions, we said, exceptions can be triggered by something outside what's running on the system right now, or something the system does, the processor is doing right now. And signals are the same way. Something outside your program can trigger a signal. or they can be triggered by sort of and triggered by special events. So I probably should move this to here, but like things outside your program, like a user pressing Control C, so that actually creates a signal that you could handle. And they can be triggered by events within your program. So it turns out that when your program does a divide by zero, what Linux does about that is it triggers a signal that you could in fact handle and decide to do something different on a divide by zero, like maybe sort of print, show an error message to the user saying to make a bug report, for example. And like exceptions run an exception handler, some code written by the OS, signals run a signal handler, which is some code written by whoever made the process. So user code, but it's run the same kind of way as exception handlers in that it's to ask the program to handle some event in the middle of doing something else. So I have this sort of comparison table. So with exceptions, the hardware, the handler runs in kernel mode. With signals, the handler still runs in user mode. It's still part of your program. With exception, the hardware decides to run a handler because it needs some help from the OS. With signals, the OS decides to run a handler because it wants some help from a program about deciding what to do in this situation. What do I do about the user pressing Control C? What do I do about your program dividing by zero, et cetera? And in an exception, we didn't talk about this in detail, but in exception, one thing that kind of glossed over is that when an exception handler runs, we need to be able to jump back to the code that started the exception handler. So the hardware is going to save the program counter to do that. With a signal handler, the OS is actually going to save our program counter, and it's also going to handle saving the registers. It's going to make a function call for us. And with an exception handler, since it's something the hardware is doing, the exception handler changes what instruction the processor is running. But a signal is something that happens in your thread. So it changes what instruction your thread runs, but whether that's the next instruction the processor runs depends on whether we've switched to your thread or not, whether your thread's actually on a processor or not. So we have this relationship, and one thing that is the main reason we're going to talk about signals, now they seem kind of unrelated at this point, even though they have, like, they're similar mechanism, but they seem unrelated as far as when they're used. Very often, the OS will run a signal handler in response to an exception. So this is a way where you can kind of have something that acts like an exception handler, but the way that's going to work is the hardware will run the OS's exception handler, and the OS's exception handler will call your signal handler. So this is a way that you can handle, you know, exceptions in your program. You're not going to be writing code in kernel mode, but the hardware will forward the exception to you to do whatever you want about it. So as an example of this, here I have a program that reads some input and prints out what it read. And let's say I run this as follows. So I have my program, and I'm showing the input in not bold and the output in bold. So I type in some input and a new line. It gets to this fgets. The fgets fills buff with some input and a new line, and I print that out. Then I print more input, input more input, and it prints out red more input using this printf here. And then I press Control C, and the program terminates. So you may have learned Control C on Linux generally makes the program stop doing things. But I could modify this program by just adding some stuff before that loop such that when I press Control C, it just outputs something saying, oh, you press Control C, and keeps going. And that's because Control C can be configured to run a signal handler. So what's this stuff I'm going to add that's going to run some code in my program in the middle of this fgets call, right? I'm just reading input, and suddenly we're going to jump to this code I haven't shown you that's not in this loop that's going to print out that control C press message. So here's what the setup, that setup code looks like. There's a lot of boilerplate in here, which is boilerplate. But sort of the fundamental thing we're doing here is we have this call to a function called sigaction, which is going to ask the OS to register a handler for a signal called sigint. And sigint stands for interrupted. It's what control C does by default on Linux. And I'm saying, when sigint happens, I want you to use this struct sig action here to determine what to do about it. And I've set up this struct sig action to have a pointer to this function handle sigint. So I'm telling it, hey, when control C happens, don't just kill my program. Please just run this handle sigint function for me. And this handle sigint function is going to write a message to the screen. Question?
Yeah, for sig action, you need to have one call per signal, right?
The question for sig action, for each signal type, so I talked about interrupts being control C, but you've gathered there must be others, since that's an argument, I need to have one call for each one, yes. Okay. Other questions? So I've set up this handler, and the OS will run it for me when control C happens, rather than the default action of just terminating my program. Other questions about this? OK. And as that question alluded to, there are a bunch of other signals. So there's a lot of events which by default terminate your program, but what they actually do, as far as Linux is concerned, is they cause your program to be sent a signal, and the default handler that the OS has for that signal is exit the program. And sigint is one of these. So control C, all it does is generate this sigint signal, but the handler for that the OS installs for you is just terminate this program. And what the code I showed there before did is it just replaced that handler with one that doesn't terminate the program. Instead, it prints a message out. And there's a bunch of other signals you're familiar with. So there's a signal for bus error and segmentation fault. So those, in fact, they don't just kill your program. They send a signal. And if you have a handler for that signal, that handler will try to run, and it could potentially do something about that. Now, for segmentation fault, probably the only thing you can really do is, like, you know, save some information for debugging, but you can do that in some real programs you might use. In fact, set up a handler like that, where they just, when a seg fault happens, save information for debugging and then exit the program. And we have control C. There's a divide by zero, it turns out, generates a floating point exception because Linux is bad, Unix. This is not just Linux, it's bad at naming things. There are signals for writing to places you don't want. There's some signals that exist so you can use them however you want, and that's what we're going to use in the lab, because there's going to be ways of explicitly making a signal happen. There's also two special signals, sigkill and sigstop. So sigkill, when you send it to a program, it terminates the program, and sigstop suspends the program, so it keeps it from running until you send another signal to the program to make it start running again. And these are special because you can't set up a handler for them. If you ask to set up a handler, the OS is just going to ignore that and keep the default handler, which terminates your program or stops it. So questions about these types of signals? So, might say, I mentioned we could handle seg fault, so let's look at that. So we can use the same thing we did before to set up a handler for the seg fault signal, which is spelled sig, S-I-G-S-E-G-V, is the sort of constant for it. And my handler prints I had a seg fault, You might say, well, that makes the segfault go away, doesn't it? Well, if I take this program here, so I set up a handler for my segfaults that goes to this function, and then I'm running this piece of assembly that accesses a crazy memory location, so it triggers a segfault. If I run this program, it just goes into an infinite loop, outputting got segfault, got sig segv. So what's happening there is, well, we have the segfault happen, it runs my handler prints out a message, and it returns, and the OS goes back to running this move instruction. And it triggers another segfault. And it tries again, and again, and it just keeps doing that because I haven't done anything to stop that from happening. And this is why you probably can't set up a useful segfault handler without doing a lot of extra work. You'd have to somehow make this access work. Yes, over there. Question is, where are these things I have here defined? So we have this struct sig action, and I have this sig action system call. Where are those defined? And did I put it in here? No. So not shown in this program is an include signal.h and some other includes. Does that answer your question? Yes. The question is, does this SA restart thing I have in my boilerplate have anything to do with it rewriting the instruction? And the answer is no. So we'll talk about what the SA restart flag does probably next time. But the reason it reruns the instruction is because it didn't finish that instruction. So the next thing we have to do is run that instruction. And when our signal handler returns, we go back to where we were. Where were we? We were about to run that instruction. Does that answer your question? So we've seen this sig action function. There's a few other interesting functions related to signals. For the most part, I'm not going to go into as much detail as you could go to by reading the documentation or readings on them. So we saw sig action for registering a handler for a signal. There's also a call to send a signal to a particular process. So if you want a process to receive a signal, or for example, to tell the process to terminate, which is why it has the name kill, that's usually a kill function to do that. There's a function called pause, which puts a process to sleep until it receives some sort of signal. So that's a way you can have a program go to sleep and have some other program wake it up later. And there's the function sigprocmask, which does this thing called blocking signals. So what that's useful for is sometimes you're not ready to handle a signal and you want to handle it later. So you can block it temporarily, and then later on, you can unblock it and then handle it then. So if you block a signal, it doesn't stop you from getting the signal, it just makes the signal be pending until you unblock it. And while it's pending, you won't handle it yet, but the OS will remember, yep, you have a control C you need to handle later, for example. And we'll look more at some of the signal API and some caveats about why writing signal handlers that don't make your program break is, in fact, way harder than it looks from what I've shown you so far. Yeah, question? The question is this how C does exception handling with Java? No, we can talk separately, but the reading on long jump is probably more relevant to that.